5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Model Moon!
The dark side of the Hoddle Moon. Immutably amazing crypto wisdom. This is the Dark Side of the Hoddle Moon Crypto Basics Show. This is a great episode to refer your no-coiner friends and family to, or if you're a beginner yourself, you're about to learn about blockchain, off-chain, on the dark side of the Hoddle Moon.
This show is proudly sponsored by Salamantech's point-of-sale devices and software. Tired of all the headaches dealing with cryptocurrency? You don't know what a private key is? You don't want to deal with exchanges? Well, if you're a business and you just want to run your business without thinking about cryptocurrency headaches, look no further than Salamantech. We provide point-of-sale software that allows you to get paid in fiat currency, that's euros, allowing your customers to pay in cryptocurrency, that's BTC, ETH, and a host of others.
Stand by. Dark Side of the Hoddle Moon proudly uses the audio services of Eye the Sound. Beyond the amazing sound production, they've really been a sounding board, pun intended, for our show, giving us great customer support and constructive criticism and feedback. So if you want a little bit more personalized attention you're not going to get from a bigger provider, check out iThesound.com.
So what do I do with this internet money I got here?
Hello, welcome to Crypto Support. How can I help you, sir?
So, I accidentally sent my 250,000 satoshis to my Instagram account. Can you reverse the transaction?
Do you understand how Bitcoin actually works, sir?
It's like that internet money. It's like a super Visa, right?
No. What you need to do is make sure that you have your private key. Do you have your mnemonic phrase at hand?
My mnemonic phrase? What's that?
Oh, boy. We're going to have some trouble with you. Well, even if you did know what it was, you shouldn't share it with me, okay?
So you're saying that if I sent it and I lost it, I can't get it back? I can't call Mr. Nakamoto and have him send it back to me?
Unfortunately, he's occupied at this present time. So no, you cannot just simply call Satoshi Nakamoto.
Okay, but I want to have a lot of Bitcoins in my wallet. In my wallet right now, I have about $30 and I have like 5 quarters and 10 dimes. How many Bitcoins can I fit in a standard wallet? Are they about quarter size or a little bit bigger?
Excuse me, sir. I think that you are mistaken. Let's review what you need to understand today on Dark Side of the Hoddle Moon.
Yes, don't get scammed by crypto scammers. Learn all about crypto with the new BitConnect Decentralized. You will automatically get 20% gains every week. And it's run by Carlos's new 3.1 BitConnect Decentralized Super Algorithm. And we're back with the Dark Side of the Moon Hoddlecast. I'm Blockade, aka Cade Crypto.
And I'm Josh Igo, aka Josh Igo.
Yeah, and I'm over here in the U.S. It's actually the day after 4th of July. I'm a little hungover myself. I was drinking a little bit too much high ABV freedom juice. How was your 4th of July, Josh?
Well, I'm a Brit, so it's always a reminder of you guys just giving up on, you know, all the good things in life that you could have won. But nevertheless.
Yeah, we're still horrible at drinking tea over here, and you know, I really miss the powdered wig sometimes. But yeah, I'm a little hungover, but I'm gonna power through it. This show is immutable; it's getting put out every week. So hungover, not hungover, I'm doing it. All right. So I think Josh, me and you have kind of had the same thing. You know, we have a lot of friends and family that are into crypto and they have all kinds of beginner questions. So you think we should do a little crypto basics for everyone today?
Yeah, let's do a crypto 101, blockchain 101.
Okay, so I think a lot of people are into crypto. They think of it as, you know, the internet money. And a lot of people see that its value has been going up. So a lot of people think of it as an investment and a way to make money. In order to get crypto, you have to usually buy crypto, usually with a fiat currency, the British pound, the euro, the dollar. So the most basic of the basic is how to buy. So can you give me a list of certain ways to buy and what's probably the easiest for a beginner?
The easiest for a beginner is to go to Coinbase. That is the most straightforward way. Now, that depends on where you live. If you're in the United States, if you are in the UK, then Coinbase is very straightforward. I think that's where you should start because you can buy with your Visa card. It's not complicated. The design of the website is very slick and it's designed for newbies in mind. So last year in 2018 was called the bear market or the crypto winter, as we like to say, right? But in fact, for sites like Coinbase, it was their most profitable year because these types of websites, they just act as an intermediary between yourself and acquiring your first Bitcoin or other digital asset. And for them, it's irrelevant what the actual price is. They make a small, let's say, commission on every trade. So They were the big winners last year. It's like, they're the banks, they're the casinos, they are the infrastructure that's required to onboard people into crypto and get their fiat converted into Satoshis.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we definitely don't want to make it too complicated here for these beginners. But yeah, I definitely agree that for most people, especially if you're in the US, Coinbase is the most common on-ramp into crypto. There's other ways you can do it as well. You can do it in person if you know someone that has crypto and they want to sell it. You can pay them cash in person. Local.bitcoins.com, they have an exchange. In the US too, a lot of malls have crypto ATMs where you can either buy or sell crypto. So that's also a pretty easy way to do it. And there are other options as well. There's if you have a stock brokerage account, you can do a crypto ETF, ETC, ETPs, but those are a little bit complicated. Maybe we'll cover that in a future issue. So yeah, you just sign up just like you sign up to any other website and, you know, use your bank or your credit card and you can buy it. And some wallets that you have on your phone, which we'll talk about later, you can also just buy with a credit card. So I think it's getting pretty easy these days.
Yeah, definitely. The reason I recommended Coinbase is just because it is the most well-regulated, well-established, well-run company based in the United States. So it's quite an upstanding business. I mean, if you look at their trading volume compared with their reported volume, it's identical. So
yes, definitely. They have a good reputation, and that's something we're going to cover later, is where you buy your crypto and store it. It's really important what their reputation is.
Yeah. Also, Kate, I'm just curious, where did you first buy your first cryptocurrencies? Which websites did you use? Can you think about it?
Yes, I think I too onboarded on Coinbase first, and I think I might have done some local.bitcoin.com stuff before that. And then from there, you can move your crypto wherever you want. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. Where did you first buy your crypto, Josh?
Actually, the very first exchange that I bought it on was called CEX.io. And I don't even know if it's still available. It's a UK-based exchange, and they accepted Visa. Then the second time that I purchased was on Corbit. And Corbit is a Korean exchange. So I've only actually purchased with fiat Bitcoin twice.
Yes, yes. I was on Corbit too until they kicked off the American customers, and exchanges are something we're going to talk about later. Well, that's pretty simple. That's pretty basic. So let's go on to the other part. You can buy crypto and you can also sell crypto. So some people try and buy it, and when the price goes up, they sell it for some gains. And as far as the options to sell crypto, I think I would recommend most of the same things. So you can sell on a lot of exchanges that have a fiat on and off ramp. You can sell in person, person to person. I know I've done that a little bit, you know, in the Boston and Providence crypto community. So there's a lot of different ways to sell as well. What do you recommend, or what do you think the best ways for beginner to sell crypto are?
Well, usually the best way is to get your KYC done on one of the bigger exchanges. Again, Coinbase is a great place to start. And then you can also sell and receive fiat back into your account. Now, me being in South Korea, it's a little bit more complicated. I think it was in 2017, towards of 2017, they basically decided no more non-ethnically Korean people can withdraw fiat currency. So it became a bit more of a challenge. But I would still recommend just going with the initial exchange that you deposited on and being verified on that exchange. That's normally the most straightforward way. Find one that suits you and be vigilant about a couple of things. So I'm going to recommend a site called CoinGecko.com. Lots of people know CoinMarketCap.com, but mm-hmm. I think CoinGecko.com actually has got more information. It can give you a better indication about the, let's say, the validity of an exchange. So one of the things on CoinGecko.com is in the navigation bar, there's an exchanges category. You click that, and then you can see the normalized volume, and then there's the 24-hour reported volume next to it. What you want to have is an exchange that basically has a matching normalized to a reported volume. Because then you know that they're not really playing around with how they are perceived. Now, when you've got a higher reported volume compared with your normalized volume, it essentially means that the sites are generating trades which may or may not be legitimate, and that usually have a market-making team. A market-making team is in place to drive volume, aka looking like they have liquidity, and matching orders on the order book. So what you should do is try to find an exchange that suits you, that has a very similar, hopefully a one-to-one ratio between normalized and reported volumes. That's a good place to start. And then in addition to that, they have the number of coins that are available and the trading pairs. So a trading pair would be something like Ethereum with an altcoin. So Ethereum being the base pair and the altcoin being what it's traded against. And then there's obviously Bitcoin. And then in different exchanges, they have different base pairings. So many exchanges like Tether, which is USDT. However, these days, many of the coins that are quote-unquote stable coins, they are competing against each other. So Tether's, the curious case of Tether's is quite interesting. If you look into the history, there's an article with that title that I would recommend you read on Medium. But there are competing ones as well, like MakerDAO has its DAI, which is a stable coin, which uses market forces to keep the price pegged as close to a dollar as it can. Then there is Circle, which has its USD coin, which is very interesting. Then there's True USD, there's PAX, and I'm sure there are others coming along now. So
let's get into crypto trading here, because we're going to get off into the more advanced stuff pretty soon. When it comes to crypto trading, I guess the super basics are a lot of crypto exchanges. If you trade stocks, they work pretty similar. You can make a buy order, a sell order, market buy, market sell. You can also put in orders. So, you know, an order can go through when you're asleep. Maybe you have a price you want to sell at. You can set the price. And if the price rises to that price, it will that trade will be executed. You can have a stop loss. So pretty similar to a lot of stock trading platforms. So, and then you kind of touched about this too. So most exchanges, they have trading pairs. So in a stock exchange, you're trading dollar versus the stock. In crypto exchanges, it's a little bit more complicated. There's usually a whole list of Bitcoin trading pairs, a whole list of Ethereum trading pairs, and also a whole list of some sort of stablecoin trading pairs, which are supposed to be usually pegged to the US dollar. So that stuff is pretty similar to stock trading, but there are a few little wrinkles that are a little bit different than stock trading as well. Do you have anything else to add to that?
Yeah, so one question that some people might have is, why do they have these US stable coins? Why don't they just trade in like a fiat pairing, like a base fiat pairing? Why do they just use the US dollar? Now, some exchanges do. That would be the right and the most regulated places will have that option. So mm-hmm. Coinbase has that option. Also, some of the bigger exchanges like Bitfinex have that option to trade in US dollars. But the ones that are actually trading in many of these stable coins, they're not really licensed in the United States. So they're based outside the United States. They're based in various jurisdictions that are, let's say, friendly to business. So Malta, Hong Kong, Singapore, Seychelles, some of these quote unquote tax havens that are, so that's a point to note. So if they don't have a fiat trading pair, then that's, in my book, that's what I look at first, is if they already are regulated or not. Because in order to have access to an actual tradable fiat pairing, then they've had to go through some more regulatory hoops that they've had to jump through. So I think that's a really good indicator of how legit a site is if they've got a fiat pairing that you can trade with. So that's why I like Corbit. They had a Korean won trading pair, which is no longer available to foreigners, unfortunately. Hopefully they'll change that in the future. And news of this week, Cade, is I've been getting messages from my Korean buddies in the crypto space this week saying, what the hell's going on in Korea? I'm like, I don't know, dude, because I've not been trading in Korea for a while. I've been using like offshore exchanges for quite some time. So tell me more. And they said, actually, they cannot deposit anymore. So many of the big Korean trading sites haven't, they've stopped the deposits for fiat currency, even for Koreans. So in my opinion, this means that they're all getting their ducks in a row. They, in terms of showing that they are ready for what will be legislation coming in. Mm-hmm. I think there are rumors going around that the government will pass some kind of clear legislation in Korea, and that should be a really good thing. And hopefully they're sensible for who knows, and they also let foreigners trade to do. Anyway,
yeah,
so...
Definitely, that can be an issue some places. Yeah, if you can't buy and sell it easily, it can be a little bit of a roadblock. Let's talk about the next one when it comes to trading. So chart reading and chart patterns. You know, we could do a whole show about this, but a lot of the same charts reading and chart patterns that you see in the stock market and support lines are pretty similar here. There's different chart patterns if you're familiar with that, and support lines. And you know, some people think that chart reading and chart patterns are super helpful. Some people think reading chart patterns is like just reading the tea leaves. I definitely think they're helpful, but I definitely don't think they're gospel either. What do you think, Josh?
Yeah, I think they are helpful. And also, you've got to realize that cryptocurrency is much more volatile than the traditional Forex markets. They're not as predictable. Forex is almost... it is more predictable, whereas the cryptocurrency is more emotional. There are a lot of people that essentially read the headlines and make decisions. And if you're getting your headlines from, let's say, Cointelegraph, which is 99% sponsored news, then you might not make the best decisions. So when it comes to trading analysis, technical analysis, I would just recommend going on YouTube. Honestly, if you don't know what any of these terms are, like moving average, convergence, and divergence, if you're talking about technical analysis, if you're looking at relative strength,
you can, trading volume, all kinds of stuff like that.
The Fibonacci retracements, what is an Elliott wave, things like that. Well, actually, I don't buy into them too much. I think that you can actually read trends rather than these technical analysis things in cryptocurrency, because the larger trends is very emotional and massive moves happen very quickly.
Yeah, you've talked to me a lot about that, and that's kind of the next thing is trading psychology. So it's also not just reading the parts, but thinking, what will the mob do or what will the group do? Sometimes, people FOMO in when it's going parabolic, and it seems like that's happened quite a few times, don't you think?
Yeah. And that was really amazing at the end of 2017, when literally everybody started to ask how to buy Bitcoin. Like my brother, he is an investment banker. He lives in Switzerland at the moment. He was in London at the time.
And he didn't have any crypto.
He had no crypto. And for years, he actually thought like crypto was an absolute joke. And he was like, there's no way that this is a serious thing. Like, we could never advise any of our clients to invest, even a small percent.
When the price goes up, he's ringing you up. It's funny because I actually didn't know that about you, but my brother is also a high up in a big bank in the U.S. And I told him, you should buy... you should buy my nephew some Satoshis, and that'll be his college fund. He's like, we have meetings about crypto every day. It's not doing anything. We would never get into it. So I kind of have a little bit of deja vu there.
Yes. And then of course, when he bought, it was the 4th of January, 2018. So at the very, very peak of the bubble.
That was like, what was that? Then it was like well over 20K then, right?
Yeah, the peak of the bubble was January the 9th.
So like literally a day before the peak.
Yeah, the week of the peak, he basically bought in. So he got wrecked in 2018. I think that left a bit of a sour taste in his mouth about crypto. But then again, he doesn't really care too much.
You never invest anything
that you can't afford.
Yeah, if he's a banker in Switzerland, I'm sure he's doing okay. But you know what? He wouldn't have bet wrecked if he would have just... hodl, because it'll be up there again in no time.
He said, look, I'm not going to look at it for 5 years. He doesn't even care about the price, which is cool. He's got the right attitude about it.
Definitely.
Once he switched over to like, okay, I'm going to go into it, he's decided to go into it for the long term. So he's not too sad about it. He doesn't really think about it, I think. Anyway, so I would recommend to finish this topic about trading, just go on YouTube and type in Coinigy, and go on the playlist Bitcoin Trading. Coinigy is spelled coin, I-G-Y. So C-O-I-N-I-G-Y, Coinigy. And Bitcoin Trading playlist. They have all of the different technical analysis things that you need to know in order to trade, if that's how you want to do your trades. Now, me personally, I like the psychological trend following. There's a good book called Trend Following, but it's very repetitive. Now, I used to commute to work, so I listen to audiobooks, right? And I play the audiobooks on 2x speed. So I'm on the commute anyway, and you might as well get some kind of use out of your commute time. Well, this book, Trend Following, is like 40 hours long or something like that. And I couldn't believe how repetitive it is. So basically, just follow the trends, and that's a good way. That's a good way to trade. That's what I like to do.
Yeah. All right. Let me do one more. Let me throw a hypothetical at you, because we talked a lot about trading psychology. I could imagine, I'm not really sure when. I'm not going to make a big prediction, but I think Bitcoin will hit $100,000 maybe in a few years. And I think when we talk about trading psychology, I think, 100,000 would be like some magic number. So I think a lot of people would just have sell orders right at $100,000. So I think it might just, that would be a huge, psychological line of resistance. Or I could just see people going completely crazy and FOMOing in, and it goes up to 110, 115K, and then it drops down to 85K. So isn't there something to like big numbers and people trading psychologically? Oh, it hits 20K or it hits 50K. Like people trade just emotionally and not logically.
Well, yeah, and that's why a lot of the smart people like yourself, what you alluded to, logically, then you'd set your sell order at like 99,000.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so then you're not, when you're trying to sell at 100,000, there's actually not going to be too many buyers because that's the psychological limit. Let's say, for example, let's play that out, that example being true. I would also sell on the way up and then I would rebuy on the after people had given up that there wouldn't be enough people buying 100K. So, it's quite simple. You just have to see patterns that have happened in the past, and they often repeat. If you want to see the future, just look at history. And any time that a chart goes parabolic, it goes vertical, it can't sustain that. So it's always good to take profits. Even if you don't, you know, maximize 100% of the potential gains that you could have got or received, it's always good to actually book a profit. It's good psychologically. It's good for your, you know, your emotional well-being. It's good for your bank account. It's good for your wife or girlfriend. It's just good for your life to take profits. Mm-hmm. Yes. So a lot of the traders that just keep their money entirely in crypto or switch over to USDT, which is like a kind of a crypto, I guess, then I think they're missing the bigger picture about what this opportunity is. You've got to actually enjoy some of the profits that you can receive when you make good trades, and then it motivates you to continue to make good trades. If you never reward yourself, then you know you won't really it doesn't set you up for that mm-hmm. winning mentality that you need. I like a few of the things that I've bought with crypto that I'm really happy about. Like I bought a nice massage chair with it, and those things are a couple of $1,000. I basically bought a car with it, and you know I've gone on a bunch of holidays with it. I've bought some nice golf clubs, things like that. Not crazy expensive things. I haven't bought a house or anything like that with crypto gain, but those nice things that like $1,000 golf set that you just cash out and just take the profits. That's nice. It's always nice.
Yeah, definitely. You definitely want to, you know, lock in some profits and also, yeah, reward yourself. But at the same time, too, you don't want to look back and be like, why did I sell Bitcoin at $100? So, yeah, you definitely want, you know, take profits when you can. So one thing when he talks about crypto trading is unless you're just trading Bitcoin to stablecoin, Ethereum to stablecoin, you're really trading for more Satoshis. You're trading against altcoins. So can you talk a little bit about that strategy? You know, altcoins were really huge, I think, you know, I would say in late 2017. And now it seems people are trading more of the, you know, top 100 cryptos on CoinGecko. They're not trading these crypto number 574.
Yeah. Now, what is an altcoin? Let's help the audience in case they don't know. It's alt means alternative, coin, aka not Bitcoin. So even some people say that Ethereum is an altcoin.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But Ethereum has become like a premier coin that has a lot of trading volume. So let's not classify that as an altcoin. Let's call the premier coins Ethereum and Bitcoin. Altcoins are anything apart from those. And many of them are what's known as an ERC-20 protocol, ERC-20 coin. It's a token that is built on top of the Ethereum network. So it's basically just a tokenized asset generated by a smart contract on the Ethereum network. Many of these altcoins are completely useless. They are not really anything but just a token and a promise, like an IOU that later on will become a valid project with something that you can use in the real world. Many of the projects that were ERC-20 coins that are now more legit, let's say Qtum, for example, they switched over from an ERC-20 to a mainnet to have their own native blockchain. Now, what that means essentially is that many of these ERC-20 tokens placeholders for mainnets until they have actually developed a mainnet, then many of these ERC-20 tokens are not really worth too much. I'm sure we might get some different opinions about that in the audience as this goes along. But in my opinion, it's not very difficult to make an ERC-20 token. You can actually, if you have a skilled developer, they can make one in, you know, under an hour. So it's, and the learning curve for it is pretty low. I mean, even if you're not a coder, you could just follow a tutorial and you could make your own coin. So for that reason, I would say altcoins are non-fat fat protocols. So Bitcoin, Ethereum, Ripple, Litecoin, even the forks of Bitcoin like Cash and SB, they are their own protocols, and that makes them more legitimate rather than just tokenized assets on top of a different blockchain.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about this when it comes to like the crypto nuts and bolts, the tech of this. We'll talk about that a little bit later too. All right, two more quick things with crypto trading, and then we'll move on to crypto storage. So you talked about this a little bit before, but when it comes to crypto trading, there's a lot of exchanges. There's a couple big ones maybe you've heard of, but there's dozens, maybe hundreds of exchanges. So I kind of want to ask you, like, which ones do you like to use? Which ones do you recommend? Is it important to have a fiat on and off ramp? And maybe I'll touch on this first. We've talked about Coinbase. I use that. That's what most Americans do, especially to get on. But I'm also, at one point, I was on like 8 different exchanges. I think now I'm on Coinbase. That's mostly my fiat on and off ramp. And if you're more advanced, you might be on different exchanges. So I'm also on Binance, I'm on Bittrex, I'm on KuCoin. And I'm doing that because maybe the trading costs are less, or maybe you can do some sort of arbitrage, or you can't find certain trading pairs on every different platform. But I think it's huge what you said. You want an exchange that's reputable and that you can trust, because a little bit later, we're going to talk about why it's so important to trust the exchange you're using. So do you agree with those recommendations? And do you have any ones that you like to use? And when it comes to picking an exchange, what do you think?
Yeah, those points are completely right. The only ones that I've bookmarked, I'm looking on my Google Chrome browser right now. I use Upbit Singapore. That's good because they have a Korean one, they have a Singapore one, and an Indonesia one. And me, as a non-Korean living in Korea, I like using Upbit, but I have to use the Singapore version. So I recommend that. Upbit is partnered with Bittrex. I also use Bittrex. I think they are a reputable company. And I have Coinbase saved. Now, I have traded on many of the exchanges that are well known now, like Binance is very well known. That's purely crypto-to-crypto exchange on Binance.com. They do have different jurisdictions, like they've got Binance Jersey, which is not Jersey in the United States, but the actual island, which is very close to the United Kingdom. It's actually closer to France. It's one of the United Kingdom overseas territories. Jersey has a British pound and euro on and off ramp for Binance, which is quite interesting. However, it's very low volume. I have used Bitfinex, Kraken, KuCoin, HitBTC. I've used Bitstamp. I've used OKX because when I was working for HiCon, we traded a lot of HiCon on OKX. I think OKX is a fairly good exchange. The offering is nice, but the problem that I see is that the trading volumes don't actually match to what their reported volumes are. So in this weird sense, a lot of these exchanges are really hurting their own ecosystem because they want to be number one. And in order to be number one, many of them have market makers in play that make the volume appear a lot higher than it actually is in reality. There's no actual real liquidity on these exchanges. I mean, there are in the tens of millions of dollars of liquidity daily, but they report in the hundreds of millions and even the billions of dollars daily, which is not accurate. So they will all want to race to the top of CoinMarketCap rankings because they perceive then that they're the best. But in fact, they're hurting themselves because you have to pay market makers in order to run these high volume trading pairs. Mm-hmm. And that costs a lot of money. So they're losing a lot of money.
Yeah, that's the market maker. That's really a dark side of the HODL moon, kind of dark secret. And yeah, I mean, obviously the volume looks good, but trust is all you have when it comes to crypto exchange. So if you have a reputation for fake volume and doing all kinds of other things that are fake and not actually what the market is showing, yeah, that's going to hurt you in the long run. You might, you know, once people wise up to what you're doing, it's not going to help your exchange at all.
Yeah, in many cases, it's counterproductive for these exchanges. But there is a lot of short-sightedness that goes on because, you know, there's egos in play. Humans are humans, and they want to be number one, even if it means I'm pounding my chest, I'm number one, but you're not really because you don't actually have the real volume. Mm-hmm. You don't have the real users. Another reason that I like CoinGecko is that it allows you to see the visits according to SimilarWeb. Now, SimilarWeb just tracks ranking of visits, and that shows how popular an exchange actually is in terms of people visiting the site. So by far and away, the number one is Binance, followed by Coinbase, then Bittrex. Now, Bittrex is number three in terms of visits, but number 12 in terms of its reported volume. And then you've got, surprisingly, Indodax, which is an exchange for Indonesians. That is number 63 in terms of what their volume is, but it's number four in terms of visits. So that shows you this kind of weird way that the crypto exchange rankings are, you know, conceived, especially if you just follow CoinMarketCap. But even CoinMarketCap is changing a little bit. They've got a reported and an adjusted exchange ranking. But I like CoinGecko. There are more things that you can look into, including the social side, which is quite important. Social mm-hmm. being like social media, how many Twitter followers they have, the Alexa rank, and also it shows you which country they are based in. So generally, if an exchange is based in the United States or the United Kingdom, then they are more likely to be compliant with regulations, especially the United States, because the SEC have been, the SEC, the people working there, they want a win for their own careers. They want to shut down some stuff because it's good for mm-hmm. their own. You know, it's good for their own careers. So that's why the exchanges that are in the United States tend to be extra vigilant. And if they're not, then they're just naive and stupid. So, yeah, that's a good place to start.
Yeah. And the last thing is, I guess, one other way you can exchange cryptos besides an exchange or, you know, bartering with someone else is you can exchange on some desktop wallets and some mobile wallets. So I know back in the day on Coin Hustle, you recommended the Exodus wallet where you can actually exchange in wallet. And I know where I'm from right now, everyone's hyped on the Atomic wallet where you can also exchange your coins in the wallet. So I think in some ways they have advantages, like, you know, it's going to be more secure. You have control of your assets, but maybe the fees are higher, or, you know, you don't get the best prices all the time. But that's also another option people have. And what do you think about those options and those options as far as beginners?
Yeah, that is a great place to start. And I can't believe that I forgot to mention that. Thanks for reminding me. Those wallets like Exodus and Atomic Wallet, which are on your PC, or I think there are even Mac versions now. They are really good for beginners because the UI is really good. It's smooth. It's clean. It looks more like a finished product than many of the, if you just run the GUI versions of like a Bitcoin miner, it looks like it was from 1997 Windows or something like that. Whereas Exodus is very slick, very nice. And it also has basically all of the top coins, so you're not really missing out on anything. We didn't really go deep on the altcoin hunts mm-hmm. that we could go into yeah. later, but you don't really need many of the altcoins, and you really need to know what you're doing in order to trade them. and actually be profitable rather than just guessing. So Exodus, great wallet. I actually still use it. I like how secure it is, and the UI is great, but I don't really recommend it for the exchange, apart from if you just really have no other options, just because the price isn't as good as you could get elsewhere, basically.
Yeah, and does the Atomic Wallet, they have a desktop version?
Yeah, they do. I installed it just to check it out.
Okay.
And, I uninstalled it because, you know, it is basically just a competitor to Exodus, and I didn't really see any real big advantage for me. But it's quite good. I also Trust Wallet from Binance. That's a good mobile wallet. And then if you look at Jax on your mobile, that's quite good. And then also on your, well, for Ethereum coins, I would recommend looking at MetaMask. How's the audio, Cade? Is it okay for you?
Yeah, I hear you fine. You're coming in loud and clear right here. Okay. It's funny. I didn't even know Atomic had a desktop wallet because I just have it on my phone. It's just so much easier because I always have my phone on me, so I can always trade if I have to. All right, so we're talking about wallets. That kind of is a smooth transition into our next topic, crypto storage. So there's a lot of different ways to store your crypto, and that's a very important topic. It's kind of one of the most important topics related to crypto security and crypto storage. So the different ways to store your crypto. So you can store it in a hot wallet, in a cold wallet. You can store it online in a hardware wallet. So I think we'll just kind of really run down all the different ways. I'll just touch on them all briefly, and you can jump in at the end or whenever you feel like. So first way you usually get crypto is you buy it on an exchange like Coinbase. And the thing that's super important here is that they actually have the what we would call the keys to your crypto. You don't own them. So you have to go on an exchange you can really trust to store your crypto on an exchange. Another thing we have are online wallets, which are also similar. And also, you still don't control your keys usually. So we have two different versions of wallets. We have custodial and non-custodial wallets. So Josh, could you tell me a little bit about the difference between those two?
Well, what I want to talk about really is the difference between hot and cold first. Let's go back to that. So what is a hot wallet? What's a cold wallet? What I would say essentially is a hot wallet is where it's online and it's more likely to be hacked, or there is a higher chance that it could be hacked. And cold storage is where everything is offline. It's not connected to an exchange. So an example of a cold wallet could be a paper wallet, which is just your mnemonic phrase written down on a piece of paper, which, you know, has its pros and cons. And another example, do you use any of these hardware wallets, Cade?
Yes. I thought you were going to say name some hardware wallets. Yes.
Yeah. So I do. I am. So I'm just wondering if you had it. So I use a Ledger. Do you have a Ledger
Actually, I'm going to walk over and grab my Ledger. I have a few Ledgers and I have a few others. So maybe I'll show them to the camera if you're just listening to the podcast. I'm just walking around right now doing my thing. But yeah, I have a bunch and I want to show them for the camera here.
Okay. And I don't know if that's the smartest thing. If you just keep your all your crypto in a
computer. Yeah, well, these don't have crypto on them.
Oh, okay. They're just for demonstration purposes.
You know, I'm a I go to crypto conferences and you get a few free ones here and there. So sometimes they just give you promos and stuff. Okay. So this is an old one that I don't use anymore, and it's a Ledger Nano. And I think this is just the box. Actually, I don't have the wallet in there, but you can kind of see it's just a little stick. It plugs in like a USB. And the private keys are on the USB. So it's pretty secure. It's basically unhackable. And the private keys are in that hardware wallet. So you can't really, there's no really way to hack it. And once you unplug it, it's untouchable. So that's one of the best ones. I think Nano has Ledger Nano. Someone gave me someone that's a little bit easier. A lot of them have a keyboard, but if it's hard to read or a little hard to use, the Ledger Blue, that has its own little touch screen. So that has, it's really user-friendly. If you have a lot of different cryptos, I recommend it. I have some limited edition pizza box ledgers that I'm hodling. I think these are going to be more like keepsakes. Maybe I'll sell them to a Bitcoin OG in a few years for a little crypto. And yeah, there's also smaller wallets too. Like I got this, I don't know, S-Qubit wallet, and it's a little bit different, a little interesting. But honestly, I wouldn't use something like this myself unless I just had a small amount on it, because it's some new Chinese hardware wallet and it doesn't have a reputation, and it doesn't have a, no one knows how secure it is. You know, there could be some sort of backdoor, some way for them to take your funds. So it's super important to use a hardware wallet you trust.
Yeah. So the ones that are reputable would be like the Ledger that you have. Also Trezor is fairly good. And if you look on Amazon and basically use your common sense by filtering based on customer reviews, if they've got a bunch of positive reviews and everyone's satisfied after a number of years without any reported, let's say, mishaps that are not user fault, but actually there's no mishaps on the software or the hardware side, then you can go ahead and purchase one of these lesser known ones as well. Because I was looking into that recently. There's a Chinese product that's trying to basically disrupt the Ledger Blue. Ledger Blue, I believe, is the more, it's more like a phone interface. It's got a touch screen on the front.
Yeah.
It's more simple. And there's a Chinese alternative to that, which is less than half the price. And it has received good views. I was tempted to think about it. But again, there is that China factor, which is you just never know with China. So,
yeah, if you have a lot of crypto, I'm not going to skimp on the hardware wallet, you know.
That's yeah, for definitely. Sure. So I've got a Ledger. That's the one that I use. I've used the Ledger Nano. And to answer your question, going back to custodial and non-custodial, custodial means someone else has custody of your assets, basically. So if you leave your if you leave your coins on an exchange and that exchange gets hacked, then your coins are gone, basically. That's what it means. And non-custodial means that you are in complete control of the private keys. And, you know, if you lose your mnemonic seed, then you'll never be able to get your money back, basically, and it's your fault. So it depends how responsible you want to be. And if you completely trust your exchange, then there is an argument to say you never need to take it off the exchange. However, the actual point about cryptocurrency in the first place, philosophically, is that you take control of your own finances. And therefore, I'd recommend at least understanding how to do it from start to finish. I mean, it's a very simple process. You can just generate a new wallet and practice with that. You don't necessarily have to risk any of your real funds if you're not comfortable taking it off Coinbase, for example. So yeah, I would just recommend understanding how it works so that in the future, if you do decide that you want to take control, you want to be the custodian of your own finances, then you can use the non-custodial wallet option, which is your own personal control.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. That's what I would recommend. But that is maybe not for beginners.
Yeah. And we did talk, we did mention just recently a couple non-custodial wallets, right? I think the Exodus would be considered a non-custodial wallet.
Yeah, I'd say so, because you actually control the private key.
Yeah.
So now it's interesting because it's a multi-wallet in one. It's a downloadable, executable file that you can launch on your computer. And then you have one single private key that you control. But if you lose that private key, then you're out. There's no way. You can't just call Exodus.io support team and say, I've lost my private key. Give me the password. It's not like that. So when it's, so even though the software is distributed by a company that's a for-profit company and they are making money, it doesn't mean that they themselves are responsible for your funds. You are still responsible for your funds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, I think it's kind of funny and interesting. You briefly mentioned the paper wallet, and we'll just touch on that real quickly. And the funny thing is, if you remember your private key, which is usually a series of numbers and letters, that you can actually store the crypto in your head. But a lot of people, it's more of an old school way, but you'd have a paper wallet. You'd literally just write it down, and some people would laminate it, or, you know, if your paper gets crumpled up or burned or something, you've kind of lost your money. So, but it is pretty interesting that you can store it that way, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's what's really awesome about it too. So you could just memorize a, 12 word phrase, or you could write it down somewhere safe, laminate it, and keep it somewhere safe. And, or you could just, you could tattoo it on yourself in various parts of your body. And you basically could go anywhere around the world. As long as you have that knowledge and you haven't shared that with anybody else, then you have access to your funds. It's quite a fascinating paradigm shift. It's just, that's the beauty of cryptography, I guess. So anyway, let's move on. It's getting, we're approaching the 55-minute mark. I know that we had a little bit of a discussion before we started recording, so I think it should be at least 45 minutes now into this podcast.
Yeah, we're right at the 45-minute mark here. All right, I'm just going to say one more thing. One other thing you can do besides a paper wallet is people started making metal wallets. They'd take a piece of metal and they'd stamp the phrase, so then it would be like fire-resistant, water-resistant, and some companies actually make these. So it's literally a coin. It's got a barcode, and underneath the barcode is your private key is etched. So that's another way you can store your crypto. But yeah, let's get the show on the road. Let's go to crypto security. So let's run through this. I got six or seven definitely don'ts when it comes to crypto security, and maybe you might have a few extras. So number one, when it comes to crypto security, this is huge because so many people have lost their funds, lost their keys, lost their phrases, been scammed online, and this is putting a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths when it comes to crypto. So this is super important. If you listen to any part of the podcast twice, make sure it's this part. So number one is the private key stuff. So your private key is like your house key. It's like your car key. You don't want to share it to anyone. You don't want to give it to anyone, online. These ledgers aren't the ledgers that I have my crypto on. These are extras that I have, in my desk. But you don't want to show your ledger and type in the password or show your private key. People have done this. This is for your eyes only. Don't screenshot it. Don't save it on your computer. Like, this is for your eyes only. So I think that's the biggest thing right there.
Yeah, that's true. So that's basically like a couple of points all rolled into one there. How about when we talk about just using a dedicated phone or a computer? I mean, you've got that written down on this checklist. So why don't you talk about that? Do you use a dedicated phone or computer just for crypto?
Yes. I can't talk about all my security stuff because I don't want to share it online, but I can tell you just in general what a lot of people do. So
what's the 12 word mnemonic phrase of yours, Cade?
Can you just share that? I can share it with myself and myself only.
But I was just thinking about you saying, some people stamp it on some metal.
Yeah.
Isn't there a problem, like the person stamping it is going to be able to see all the 12 words and then,
they have to trust that company. Yeah, so Cold Storage Coins is a company. They make the private key and they put a sticker over it. I think they've got a good reputation, but also you can stamp it yourself. They have stamping kits. You literally buy like a chunk of aluminum and you literally stamp it out yourself with a little stamp. So if you don't trust anybody. You can make your own metal wallet.
That's cool. I think that that's probably the most prudent, most secure thing that you could probably ever do.
Yeah. So when it comes
memorizing it.
Yeah. When it comes to dedicated crypto phones and computers, a lot of people, maybe myself included, they have a computer that they only use to trade with, and they only put it online when they're trading. A lot of people have two phones. So they have like an Atomic wallet on one phone, and they have their normal phone. And the only time the crypto phone is online is when they're trading or sending funds. When they're not using it, it's offline. There's no phone number connected to it. They're just using the hotspot from their other phone. So that's pretty common practice, is using two phones, or some people have three phones. They have their normal phone, the crypto phone, the Google authenticator on their third phone. There's all different ways you can do it, but you definitely don't want all your stuff on one system, and you don't want your password saved anywhere. I know I already said that, but that's super important. What are some other things that people do for security that I think is pretty important?
Well, you just mentioned it, and that's Google Authenticator. So Google Authenticator is known as two-factor authentication. It's essentially, rather than just a email address and a password to log in and the capture, you have to then go through a second factor of authorization, which is your Google Authenticator app on your phone. Now, that proves that you are the person that is in control of the account. And what this essentially is a rotating 30-second random six-digit password. So every 30 seconds, this six digits will change, and therefore you are the person that is in control of the account. Now, obviously, if somebody has your phone and everything else, then, you know, it could be a bit of an issue, but it's more secure than not having it. So also the other issue is, if you lose your phone, it can be quite a pain to unfreeze your two-factor. And then there's a series of, let's say, weeks that you have to, I think you have to wait for at least 10 days on most of the exchanges before you can make any trades again, so that they can be sure that you are who you say you are. All right, number six.
Yeah, that's one thing I can definitely say myself is, my Google 2FA is definitely not on my normal phone. And I think if you have an extra phone, don't sell it. Just use it for crypto. Another thing is, you kind of say this a lot, not your keys, not your coins. What does that mean, Josh? And why is that so important?
Well, if you don't control the private keys, then you don't control the coins at all. You're not the owner. So when you're on an exchange, you don't actually control the private keys. You are just trusting them to deliver on your, or to execute your order, and also to execute your withdrawal, for example. Many of the exchanges have a process, which is quite good. Like, they have a fund password, which is separate from your login password. Then you need to verify your email address on a one-time authenticator. Then you need to also do a two-factor before you can withdraw. Mm-hmm. I like that, like, four steps of security. That's at least the pretense of security. But the fact is, if you don't have the private keys and you don't know the private keys for that address, even if you can see that address on Block Explorer, it doesn't mean that you control the coins. So just because it's your address on an exchange, if you don't have the private keys, they're not yours. So always revert to an address which you completely control when you're storing the majority of your funds.
Yeah. And if you listen to the show and you get into crypto, you're going to hear about a couple big scandals, like Mt. Gox, which was one of the earliest, the most famous. And I think there's recently an exchange in Canada, like, where all the coins got lost or stolen. So yeah, they're not, if you want to be the safest, you really want to store your own private keys. And then just one more thing before we move on, I just want to mention, when it comes to phones, one recent issue has been SIM card swapping. So if, you know, my crypto phones, they're, if I'm having any sort of issues, I'm not sending them to T-Mobile, because there's been a huge issue with SIM card swapping and issues with phones, if they can get a control of your phone, they can bypass some of the security things we talked about. So that's also super important. I just wanted to touch on that. And the last thing is malware, phishing sites, scam callers, online scams. Oh, send me, you know, 3 Bitcoin and you'll get 5 Bitcoin in 2 weeks. That never happens. It's always a scam. Okay. Don't fall for it. And I'm just trying to, you know, maybe use a VPN blocker. Try and keep your antivirus software up to date. And also, simple things, even they mention on Binance, make sure you're logging into the correct address of the account. Make sure it's exactly Binance.com, not Binance.com or something. So it's really important to see, make sure it says that HTTP in the beginning so you know it's a secure site. That's also a huge issue.
HTTPS.
Yes, you're right.
It needs a SSL, like a security certificate, to make sure it's secure. Also, like, in addition to what you said, be careful on sites like Telegram. Well, on I would call them sites. What would I call them? Social media apps or whatever. Telegram, especially. When I did an ICO, there were like 50 people that were pretending to be me, messaging random people saying, "Just send F to this address, and you will get like 50% bonus and random stuff like that." I had to ban more than 800 people that were either spammers or scammers. And it was quite an eye-opener when you realize just how many scammers are out there. And like the ICO we did was successful in terms of money raised. But in terms of like overall awareness, most people still don't know what that project is. And the fact that there were so many scams just for that project just shows how big of a risk it can be. So on Telegram, be extra vigilant. Don't ever send money to people because they've requested it. There is no unclogging fee for anything. They don't need you to send some Ethereum so that you'll get 10 back, anything like that. Just block those people and report them. That's the number one thing you should do. It's a real shame that this exists, but then again, there is a lot of there's a lot of poverty out there, and there's a lot of you know, unscrupulous people that are willing to take advantage of people. So be vigilant. If you want to get into crypto and take it seriously, you have to be responsible for your own life and finances, and that's the whole philosophy of cryptocurrency. If you can't handle that, then don't get involved in cryptocurrency, honestly. Just stay in regular NPC land.
Yeah, or if you got a brokerage account, it kind of goes against the ethos of crypto, but you can just buy a Bitcoin ETF or whatever, and you can do it that way. But yeah, I totally agree. All right, the last one. So I thought about doing this first, but I thought it would be more interesting to do it last. So kind of like the crypto nuts and bolts, explaining what it is. You know, your grandma's going to say, "Oh, it's internet money. It's this or it's that." So I thought we'd just really briefly cover just the basics of Bitcoin and some Ethereum and a few other coins. So, Josh, if I asked you, what is Bitcoin? What would you briefly tell a newbie if I just said, what is Bitcoin? What is your go-to answer?
Well, it could be very lengthy, but to keep it as short as possible, it is a way for people to store data. And in Bitcoin's case, it is transactions in an immutable way without having a third party being the arbiter of those decisions. It's allowing anybody to participate in a network. So it's a permissionless system. And it is directly opposed to centralization. So that's what Bitcoin is in a nutshell. Now, the reason that's important is because it allows people to, like I've mentioned several times, take control of their own finances and their own life, essentially. So the philosophy behind it is quite clear. It's that you can be your own bank. You can just interact with other people in an economy in a voluntary way between other Bitcoin users. Now, that would be the way that I say it, but maybe that was a bit philosophical or political. I'm not sure how you put it. How would you put it even simpler, Kate? I don't know, because you're an American guy. I think Americans like to have one-liners and catchphrases and stuff. How would you describe Bitcoin?
An immutable, decentralized ledger that'll take over the world. basically what you said is basically what I think too. Blockchain is a technology, and we think of Bitcoin. So it's got five key characteristics. Security and immutability, which you mentioned. And immutability, if you don't know, means unchangeability. Once a transaction goes through, you can't change it. There are no chargebacks. You can't call up anybody. Once it goes through, it is done. So that's huge because it allows for decentralized trust and a decentralized consensus through proof of work, which we'll talk about later. And also one other big thing is provenance. That just means a fancy way of tracking stuff. So you can track the movement of funds. You can track other use cases, track the origin of products or ingredients. High availability. So what this means is it's decentralized. Like you said, it's available to anyone. The radio is available to anyone. Broadcast TV is available to anyone. Internet's available to anyone, and Bitcoin is available to anyone. Anyone can get into it. And like I just mentioned, finality. Once it's sent, and that is huge.
Yeah, that is huge. I mean, technically, that's not correct, but in reality, it's correct. So like, for example, we've mentioned this last week when they make a big error, like the Ethereum, the DAOs.
Oh, yeah, the rollback. But at least when it comes to Bitcoin, it's been final, right?
Yeah, Bitcoin is essentially about hash power of the miners. So the way that it's secure is all of this data is processed by lots and lots of computers that are mining Bitcoin. The reason they're mining it is they get a reward for helping the whole network run, and they get in each block, there's a reward of Bitcoin, which is soon going to be halved. I don't know the exact number of Bitcoin that is per block right now as a reward, but there's a phenomenon known as the halving, and that's when the prices mm-hmm. tend to increase a lot because the rewards for miners diminish. Now, they keep the network secure, and they're incentivized by getting reward and making sure that the transactions are validated on the network. So if enough of these, enough of these miners decided to pull together, they could do what's known as a 51% attack on the network, and they could basically rewrite the chain. So when you've got these philosophical differences between how you approach the chain or which transactions are valid in or how to upgrade the infrastructure. In many cases, it requires a fork, a hard fork. And a fork is basically where miners decide to go with one chain and another group of miners decide to go with another chain. So in order to implement an upgrade on a blockchain, you essentially have to do a fork of sorts. Now, if all of the miners agree to that upgrade, then it's not really a fork, essentially. It's not really seen as a fork. It's still the main chain. It's the strongest.
Yeah, well, there's a small difference there. So we're talking small difference between like a soft fork and a hard fork. So a soft fork is kind of backwards compatible, and usually most people upgrade. A hard fork is when it completely splits. We saw with Ethereum Classic, and the Bitcoin and all the Bitcoin forks. Let's talk about the other big crypto. Some people call it an altcoin. I don't, but Ethereum. And so Ethereum. It was built to do things that maybe Bitcoin can't do or can't really do as well. It uses a different programming language. And two big things it has are, besides the tokens that you can build on top of the Ethereum protocol, you can also do smart contracts. And there's all kinds of ways that these could be utilized and be really beneficial. And some are, like, in the future, maybe inheritances, wills, legal contracts. And also dApps, which are decentralized applications. So This is why Ethereum is the other main crypto that you see on all the exchanges. So do you have anything to add when it comes to Ethereum?
Well, yes. But to give it some context, just to go back to Bitcoin, Bitcoin is basically, it's triple entry accounting. So if I send Bitcoin to you, you receive a Bitcoin, you have a receipt of that, I have a receipt of that, I have a ledger of that, you have a ledger of that. But also there's a third recording of that, which is the public ledger, which anybody can see and anybody can access. That's why when people say Bitcoin is scary, internet money is used for terrorism and stuff, blah, blah, blah. You've got to be an idiot to use Bitcoin for terrorism, because you can be easily tracked. It's probably the most trackable thing that you can imagine once you've identified who is, receiving those funds. But there's also a difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum. Bitcoin has a finite max supply. It uses proof of work. Now, Ethereum also uses proof of work just because it's the only viable option right now that actually works for running a consensus algorithm, in my opinion anyway. I'm sure some people think proof of stake is a great idea. I don't necessarily think proof of stake is a great idea too much when you've got a massive network. Ethereum doesn't have a hard cap. It's not designed in the same way as Bitcoin is. Instead, Ethereum is supposed to be like an online decentralized computer that can do transactions and spread the work across the network. Like the Ethereum virtual machine is basically an operating system for the network, essentially. So it allows programmers to build stuff on top of the network. And that's where it became really interesting. And that's where the kind of ICO bubble started in 2016, 2017, where there was this idea that you could program anything on top of Ethereum and we could tokenize everything. And like the Ethereum if this, then that kind of way of doing things could make many industries redundant, ranging from accounting through to medical, through to, let's say, supply chains, all sorts of different things. But the ICO bubble popped because when it actually transpired that it's really difficult to actually produce something like that, you can actually do that. And at best, it's more like a vending machine rather than a computer, in the sense that when you put a quarter into a vending machine and press a button, you get a can of cola, can of Coke. Ethereum isn't too complicated in terms of what it can do right now. And that's why Vitalik, who was one of the core developers who helped write the Ethereum white paper, always says, we're well away from this future. And he said that they haven't really justified the $1 billion market cap that they received once. Mm-hmm. So it's something to think about. Ethereum is slightly different from Bitcoin for those reasons that we mentioned. Ethereum is, it's got a more active community of developers. I know a couple of the people that are trying to solve the scalability issues on Ethereum. Now, when we talk about scalability, what does that mean, Cade? Because I forget that we're talking to, or we're aiming this episode at beginners sometimes.
Yeah, scalability, I think, what does that mean? That was a lot of good information. But yeah, some of that might be over the head of some of our beginners too, but they'll catch on. Scalability, that is one issue with Ethereum is, can it handle the throughput or the volume on the network? So that is something they're trying to solve with Ethereum, and that's why you've seen competitors. I forgot how, lost track of how many there are, but they're trying to solve the scaling issue, which means having enough volume to execute all these smart contracts. So you've got Arc, Lisk, EOS, Cardano, and a bunch of other chains trying to solve this problem. So I hope Ethereum can solve it, but if not, someone else will hop into the market and figure it out. And also, when you talk about scalability, that is kind of what led to the Bitcoin hard fork, because there is an issue with scaling and transaction fees when Bitcoin got really popular. So I don't know. When I was trading at that time, it's kind of the consensus now that, Bitcoin is kind of like a store of value, or you can only use it for large purchases and you can't use it for small purchases anymore. I think when the blocks got full, I think I paid over $50 for one transaction. So that doesn't have any benefits. And that's why Bitcoin's forked into BTC and BCH. So that was also a huge issue with scaling.
Yeah, I mean, the scalability issue is something that the blockchain community hasn't fully reconciled, to be honest. If you want to have a decentralized, permissionless coin that wants to be used in the real world, then scalability is paramount. You need to be able to solve that, because currently Bitcoin can handle 7 to 8 transactions per second. Whereas if you compare that to the Visa network or any like the major card, it just pales in comparison. Like, we're talking in the tens of thousands of transactions, even, and maybe hundreds of thousands that can be done on Visa. If you think about all the transactions that are carried out around the world on e-commerce, in shops, restaurants, by Visa, it's just astounding. Bitcoin can't handle that amount of throughput. It's just not a viable thing. And when the blocks get full, then there is not... So the reason that you had to pay such a high fee to get your transaction through is because miners will not mine your transaction because they're not incentivized to do so. Because your reward, when you send Bitcoin, there is a small transaction fee. You can determine how small or large of a fee that is. And if you pay more, you basically are more likely to get taken up into the next block in the main pool. And you're going to be, your transaction will be carried out much quicker because the miners are incentivized to do it. So that's where you had this massive inflation in terms of the price of even transacting in Bitcoin. Made a lot of people realize that, hold on, we're not really going to build this new paradigm of a financial system when it's basically free for me to transfer money internally from US dollar to US dollar, right? If you want to send US dollars to your friend, it doesn't really cost too much. In the United Kingdom, bank-to-bank transfers, they take a few hours, but they don't really, there's no charge for that. It's the same for across the European Union. It takes a couple of hours, even after, I think it's a few days at first, and then after the account's been transacted at least once, I think it's 3 hours. So the traditional banking system is definitely improving thanks to Bitcoin, and it's like woken them up to the idea of, you know, people having a choice over how that they exercise their, I don't know, economic rights or whatever, which is only a good thing. I mean, it's a great thing that we've got these up. Hey, are you on your motorcycle?
No, I'm just in Harley Central right here. Like, Harleys are big here where I'm from in the U.S., so everyone's revving their Harleys down the street. I'm here in my crypto bunker, top secret location.
So anyway, I've lost my train of thought there, really, but I think I'm getting a bit rambly anyway. So let's move on to the next point, I guess.
Yeah, I think the source code fork, soft hard fork, so that's a little bit too complicated for beginners. So let's just skip that. I thought maybe if you wanted to, you could briefly touch on altcoins, and then we'll end maybe with proof of work, proof of stake, and maybe just talk about proof of work and mining and what it is. So we kind of already talked about altcoins. You know, there's just different cryptos that have different use cases. A lot of them are built on Ethereum or built on Neo. I don't really have much else to say about altcoins in this issue or in this podcast. Do you have anything to add when it comes to altcoins?
Yeah, altcoins are cool. Some of them are great. What you should do is, as a newbie, it might be very tempting to buy a bunch of altcoins based on what is written in the white paper. And I think that that is a natural thing for a newbie to want to do. But I would recommend going beyond the white paper, look at the team, look at their GitHubs, how many commits have they made, how long have they been programmers, how viable of solution actually is this? Is this a pie in the sky dream, or is there a realistic chance that this could work? Also, is there a market need? Is there already an option that exists in a non-crypto fashion that serves this need better already? If so, then, you know, what's the point apart from just saying blockchain because it's fun or popular, a way to raise money? I don't know. So you've got to, when you get into the world of altcoins, you've got to be looking at things from like a multiple angles, really. You need to be looking at the company that's behind it or the people that are behind it. Is it just lots of really nice marketing, or is there an actual use case there? And also, how serious are they? Have they invested in like basic stuff like good social media? Have they got a team that are going to conferences and making sure it's being promoted? Have they taken it seriously to form partnerships? Are they active, or are they, is it after they've raised the funds, are they kind of, have they disappeared? Have they all gone to the Black Sea? So you've got to think about it carefully. I liked doing all the altcoin stuff, but that was when it was appropriate to do so. That was back when the gains could be crazy and there was a lot of market euphoria around cryptocurrency. Whereas right now there's a lot of, let's say, pragmatism, and a lot of the investors are more careful and more diligent, which is good. So sticking with the bigger projects is not a bad option for beginners, honestly. So
definitely
just be wary.
Stick to the first page of CoinGecko. Don't go to the last page. I think the last thing I'd like to end with today, unless you have anything else you'd like to do, is proof of work and crypto mining. You know, when people think mining, they think mining for gold, mining for diamonds. This is mining for crypto, but the way you mine for crypto is a little bit different. And not to get too complicated, but this crypto mining is what secures the network and makes it a decentralized, trustless system that doesn't need a trusted third party. And would you like to tackle this one, Josh? Can you tell us a little bit about mining, why people do it, why miners mine, and why it benefits the system?
Okay, so why miners mine? They mine for profit. They want to, number one, receive Bitcoin as a reward. So they're doing it for financial gain. But so it's not completely altruistic. They're not like benign beings. They're basically looking to make profit. Now, the reason that we need the miners is that they run the network. They carry out the transactions. When I send Bitcoin to you, it doesn't just magically go there by itself. It's a lot of computational power. They are basically solving complex mathematical problems. This is what they call about the hash power of a network. So they're basically doing computations and hash functions that are very complex math. That if you think about an analogy that I've used before is if you took a lot of, and I borrowed this from Owen Delahoy. So if you're listening, Owen, I really like your explanation. It's a good way to explain it. He's a senior blockchain developer that I know. He basically said, look, if you make a fruit smoothie, it's pretty easy to blend it up, but it's pretty hard to put the blended pieces back together into a banana and an apple and some strawberries, right? So that's basically what the process of the hash function computational work is. It's taking really complex work and proving through a proof that the work has been done, but to like backwards calculate it and reverse the stuff that you've done is so hard, and you'd need more computational power than is profitable in order for you to justify even attempting it. So that's why the Bitcoin network is secure, because there are so many miners. The computational power required to, let's say, reverse the transactions or change the chain, it makes it not worth it. It doesn't make sense economically to even attempt it. So that's why it's so secure. That's why it's so strong. So that's proof of work, and the work is just computational algorithms. Now, there is an argument that it's a waste of electricity because it's just random work. So there are some people, now when I say random work, it's basically the equivalent of digging a ditch and then filling it back in again and then digging a ditch again. Like, there's no real rhyme or reason to it. It's a lot of energy. So some people are arguing for different consensus algorithms. So you've got, instead of proof of work, where the work is random as it is now, proof of useful work is quite interesting. So if you look at something like the Capture network, which is used as a form of verifying humanity on the internet, you've probably seen mm-hmm. it. Like, it's where you have to verify, show me the bicycles, click the three bicycle pictures, mm-hmm. or where is the street lights, or something like mm-hmm. that. Or it might be something like deciphering some text that is kind of blurry. That is useful work because it allows this all the computers to come together. And basically, it helps the machine learning algorithms, right? So some of the more interesting people I've met in my travels are trying to come up with a proof of useful work algorithm, which is really fascinating. We can get into that later in another episode. I might even put some of these people on.
Yeah.
What do you think about other things like proof of stake, DPoS, which is delegated proof of stake, and then you've got the other stuff, which is just like trusted node validators, which is more along the lines of Ripple, the Hashgraph, and also now LibraCoin.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's different ways. Oh, proof of work is crypto mining. And yeah, just to touch on that. Yeah. The more hash power you have, the more secure the network is. Sometimes there's issues with miners joining mining pools. You don't want mining pools to get too big. And I'm really into crypto mining. I would love to do a future episode on crypto mining, maybe get some guests in or ask some of the big crypto miners on YouTube to come in for an interview. And yeah, before people were mining on their computers, you can still mine your computer. You're not going to make much, but I think it's a really interesting topic. And yeah, I personally think it kind of does have value. If it costs $4,000 to mine a Bitcoin, I get how it's kind of wasteful energy, but in some ways, that's kind of what I think gives it value. And yeah, now people are thinking, like you said, it's wasteful. So we're going to go to proof of stake, delegated proof of stake. There's all these obscure ones like proof of trust, proof of caring.
So all of this is about one thing, really, isn't it? It's about consensus. It's mm-hmm. how you maintain consensus, which is essentially group agreement that the chain or the ledger, however you want to call it, is accurate and valid. So that's the really big breakthrough of Bitcoin, is that they solved the Byzantine generals problem, which is essentially how do you like communicate in a group that isn't centralized. The Byzantine general problem is where if you go back in history, they surrounded they were attacking a different army. They would surround them, but in order for them to be successful, they all needed to attack at the same time. And they didn't want to let the enemy know that they were going to attack. So they had to come up with a system where at least 60-something percent of them would attack, two-thirds of them would attack at the same time for it to be successful. So this is why we go back to this Byzantine general problem, and BFT, Byzantine fault tolerance, is a proper, is a common word in blockchain circles. So now you know where it comes from, and it's basically about consensus. It's how you come to an agreement about what is a valid transaction and what's not. And it also comes back to what the difference between Bitcoin and, let's say, internet money, quote unquote, I don't know, something like Farmville cash or whatever. It's that you can't double spend. So what happens in Bitcoin or any blockchain for that matter is when I send a transaction to you, unless everyone else on the network is in agreement, then that you've received that funds, then I could, in theory, send the same transaction to somebody else, and that's the double spend problem. So mm-hmm. the consensus solution that Bitcoin came up with was proof of work, which is still the number one way that coins are mm-hmm. Produced and the networks are run. So the reason Ethereum wants to go away from that is because it has some inherent limitations, including the scalability aspect. Mm-hmm. And then there are some other problems that come with that.
Like
proof of stake rewards the people with the most amount. So it's like ultra, I don't know, it's like more of a croniest way of doing it.
I think it depends on what the minimum is for your staking, but also the issue with mining is that the big mining farms are the most profitable too. One advantage of proof of stake, if they can make it work, is that if you try and do malicious things in proof of work, you still keep your mining hardware. With proof of stake, if you try and do something malicious, you lose your stake, which is could be a lot of money. So I think that's one advantage that proof of stake has that I'm interested to see if they can make it work on some of the protocols.
Yeah, and then there are some other coins like ARC that use DPoS, which is interesting, which is delegated proof of stake where people
vote. EO, Steam, a bunch of them use it, right?
Yeah, and that is people vote for who are going to be the validators. And, if these validators are not playing ball, so to speak, they can be, voted out. So there are lots of different ways to solve the consensus issue in a decentralized way. But then again, the easiest way is just to have it totally centralized. And then you don't really need a blockchain. You can just run a normal database. So that's kind of the interesting thing that's happened recently. It's like all of the people that talk about scalability, which is an inherent problem of many of these decentralized coins, have essentially had to go the route of getting rid of the permissionless aspects and having very centralized authority to maintain the consensus. So that's the trade-off. So if we look at Libra, like we talked about last week, all of the validators are massive corporations that have invested at least $10 million. And they want it to work because they will receive interest payments for their work of being a validator. So it's really interesting. It's like a fascinating topic, but probably too deep for the beginners are winners.
Yeah, actually, if you're interested in that topic, that was actually our first episode. And there's a couple things. Some people in the U.S. want to get Libra banned, some government committees. But I think maybe five more minutes and we'll be done. That pretty much puts us at an hour and a half. So is there anything else that you want to talk about or bring up or emphasize before we call it a day today?
Well, I think we covered a lot today, Cade, so I'm quite happy to leave it at that. Also, anyone listening, please suggest some other topics that you would want us to cover. We're happy to cover anything. We've got about the next four or five shows lined up with our own ideas and content. And then after that, we're going to start bringing on guests to discuss these issues in more depth. So if you've got any specific things that you want to hear, then please just write us a comment or reach out to us and we will try and see if we can make that happen.
Yes, definitely. We'll be on YouTube at least one video a week. We might ramp it up to two, and we're going to roll out a podcast. And when that's ready, we'll let you know. But yeah, comment below on ideas. If you have questions, any questions about anything, we're pretty interactive. We'll link our crypto Twitter, and maybe we'll get a Telegram going. We really want to interact with the community and make this something collaborative that can really benefit everybody. Josh, should I tell you about my patriotic haircut? Can you see that?
Oh, nice. You got a star and a strap. It looks like a bloody Cuban flag.
Yeah, it kind of looks like a flag from Puerto Rico. I just, I hadn't had lines in my hair since I was like in fourth grade. I'm just like, just YOLO. I gotta go out for the fourth today. Well, I think that'll do it for Blockade and Josh today, and we will see you next time on the dark side of the HODL moon.
All right, see you guys. See you next week.
Later.
Thank you for joining us on Dark Side of the HODL Moon. If you haven't already subscribed, please do so. Also, be sure to join our Telegram group, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and follow us on BitChute and YouTube, where you can find all the episodes as well as highlights from previous episodes. You can also visit us at darksideofthehodlmoon.com. HODL Moon!